So tonight I'd like to offer the second and final talk here on Vedana, this important quality of feeling tone. Just reflecting on this dependent origination, these two last links, contact and Vedana, really have an important and unique aspect or juncture that happens. And it happens in the present moment. Both these links are happening moment after moment, right? Centered here in the middle of this moment. Contact, of course, is when the sense data comes to our attention, including thought as a sense. And essentially, it's just a thought, it's just a sound, it's just a sensation. But the momentum of our past conditioning, our programming, shapes that point of contact. It can be conditioned by our past, conditioned by our history. And that conditioning is further revealed by Vedana, by this quality of being pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. This is also profoundly shaped by our past, by our history, by the past ways that we've been reactive and had triggers happen in our lives. It's programmed into us. And so these two things happen very quickly. There's a moment of contact, and almost immediately after the contact, this quality of Vedana arises. As I talked about it in the guided meditation, that sense of a subtle flavoring, like this is perceived as being pleasant. This is perceived as being unpleasant. And it's often not noticed because we quickly go into our reactivity, our sense of having something to do with this, getting more of it, getting less of it. But we can see more easily our craving or aversion is much more easy to perceive. And this is what Tori will go into next month, starting a week from today, as she takes over the next 2 months. Because once we go into craving, we're already moved past Vedana. So contact and Vedana are something that's happening right here in this very moment. And it's this place of contact that we can access with the present moment. So it becomes a very, very valuable place of practice. It helps us orient away from our world of thought, of elaboration, of reactivity, to be able to come right into this moment, to find where that moment. What actually is happening right here, right now? What is the sensation of the breath, actually? What is the sensation of the body? What is the sound that's reaching my ears? And so often we miss that, and we quickly are launched into our reaction, our response, our desire, our hatred, our selfing, creating the sense of self. This is what I talked about a couple weeks ago with the chutes and ladders game. And we get to the top of the chute and suddenly we find ourselves in a different part of the board. And so it's such a critical aspect of our practice. And so tonight I'd like to explore the movement away from Vedana, the movement down the cycle of dependent origination, and also how we can come back to just touching that one moment, that one point of contact. The moving from Vedana and the movement not moving from Vedana. Moving from feeling tone and not moving. Now, as we move away with Vedana, as it starts to move us into this cycle of craving, of wanting, of selfing, we're really going along this trajectory of the dependent origination. And things get more noisy internally. There's more mind chatter, there's more reactivity, more emotions. We are more engaged. And sometimes that engagement is very pleasant. We're really engaged with something that we love and we're passionate about. And sometimes it takes the form of obsession and worry, anxiety, of dread, as it goes that direction. So let's give an example that fits with the summertime. Let's say my wife and I were driving around to some, I forget the errand we're on, but we heard an ice cream truck. Okay, so you hear an ice cream truck, and that's just a bare sound that's reaching your ears. It's in its essence is completely neutral. The music reaches your ears, and there's that point of contact. And yet, the sound of that annoying music is not neutral. It's really shaped by our past, by our conditioning, by our programming. Now, if we're a young child and we were used to chasing after the truck and getting a treat and the excitement of that, that sound has its different quality. We really assign a different name and form to it based on our past sankharas, reviewing the last months of dependent origination. On the other hand, whenever you heard that truck as a child and you're never allowed to chase after it and get the treat, or whenever you did, got your money finally, the truck had disappeared, there's a sense of disappointment, also conditioned by our past history, conditioned into us by that simple sound, based on how we reacted to it, how we responded to it, how we experienced it, what our relationship to it was in the past, profoundly influences how we perceive it in this moment. This is what I mean by being conditioned, programmed into us. Now, if we've never experienced an ice cream truck, we're more able to stay in the neutral quality, the actual, closer to the actual contact. Well, there's a sound and we're curious. What is that sound? What is it doing? What does it mean? So after the contact reaches us, the very first impression, almost microseconds after hearing it, after we recognize it, Vedana steps in. Feeling tone. The very first impression, before we think, before we act, before we have any impulses, there's this subtle flavoring of being pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, neither pleasant or unpleasant. And from that point, we quickly go down this road of craving, of clinging, of becoming. So like the frantic rush for money to catch the truck, the anticipation, the joy, the disappointment, the pleasure, all of these are part of suffering. These are all part of dependent origination. This is happening all the time, countless times during the day. And the Buddha, through his insight and his clarity of seeing, mapped this out, showed how this process is tied intimately to our suffering, intimately to the rising of dukkha, and therefore to the cessation of dukkha. And so Vedana is the beginning of craving, the beginning of wanting, or the opposite side of the coin, the same coin, is not wanting. So this becomes the seed of the hindrances of craving and aversion. So we think about analogy of a car, and you have your gas pedal. You put the car in first gear, that's putting it into the mode of wanting. That's a pleasant Vedana. Then we put our foot on the gas, that's going down the cycle of a dependent origination, going into craving, into clinging, into becoming. What this feels like is that sense of being more engaged, more thoughts about it. How can I get this? How can I get more of this? Well, if the car is put into reverse, this is the Vedana, which is unpleasant, right? So when we have to put our foot on the gas, we go backwards. We move away from this experience. We go away into trying to escape it, to try to avoid it. And of course, we can just touch the pedal and go a few inches, miles per hour, or we can floor it and go very quickly down this path. This is how we can hear one word in the next moment, be caught in a state of reaction, of reactivity, maybe of joy, maybe of sorrow, just in a moment, because it's primed to go so deep. It's interesting to notice how many of our actions are tied and actually really driven by Vedana, by our relationship to Vedana. It becomes this trigger toward our actions. How much of what we do is to seek pleasure or to seek pain, or to avoid pain, I should say. This is a part of the homework that we'll talk about, the practice and reflection. I remember when I was doing my teacher training, my four-year teacher training with Jack Kornfield, one of the things he shared about a teacher is that their whole practice that they taught was to notice simply whenever you're moving in relationship to suffering. Whenever there's a sense of suffering, how often that leads to movement, movement to escape it, movement to overcome it. And that was her whole teaching, was noticing that movement that was motivated, that was triggered by suffering. So we go even a little bit more into that. We see that vedana of unpleasantness becomes the trigger to move, becomes the initial movement. So learning to trace back through all the elaboration, through all the distractions and engagement, to see where is that point of vedana? What is that vedana? It can be so helpful to simply say, oh, this is a pleasant experience. Oh, this is an unpleasant experience. And by doing this, there's a sense of quiet, a sense of stillness that arises from that. So noticing this initial impact, initial impulse to act, and how we reach for the dessert following a pleasant vedana, how we swat at the mosquito following the unpleasant vedana, surfing the web, perhaps trying to overcome a neutral vedana when that creates a sense of boredom, so we seek pleasure. If you look, these are constantly happening in our lives, constantly there. Some moment of contact, there's a quality of vedana being pleasant or unpleasant, and then the movement toward or away. Or if it's a neutral, if we're caught in unconsciousness and delusion, we find something to wake us up. And if we're present, that neutral vedana just allows us to rest in stillness. So vedana, I'm describing it how we usually act in, from this. It's actually, we can just meet that vedana without having to move from it. This is a very helpful part of practice. Now, vedana sometimes is a way, it gets confused with intuition, with that sense of knowing what is the right course. And learning to kind of tease that apart, that sense of being pleasant or unpleasant, isn't actually a very good guide for our intuition, for our inner knowing, for making a decision. Whether something feels pleasant or unpleasant, feeling good or bad, it's not so trustworthy. Just imagine telling the truth is painful. It's unpleasant to someone who's chronically lying. You know, having a difficult conversation to have with someone in your family, it's essential, but it feels very unpleasant. So if we just went by what was pleasant or unpleasant, it would not be a very good guide, not a very helpful way to seek it, to really touch into that deeper sense of knowing. There's a deeper well that comes forth, that sense of, I think in the Christian faith, they talk about that small, quiet voice that arises, a little small sense of knowing that vedana may or may not be there. It may be actually something that feels unpleasant to contemplate saying or doing, but deeply we know it's the right thing to do. Or vice versa, unpleasant or pleasant, and we realize, okay, I need to not do that, not follow that impulse of craving, of desire, of lust. So vedana. Now we may notice that we have a habitual way of following a particular kind of vedana as we look into it. We may find that most of our movement is toward pleasant or toward some away from what's unpleasant. I remember in a two-year course I took at Spirit Rock called the Dedicated Practitioner Program, we had a dyad working with vedana. And you just had to reflect every time there's a sense of vedana that would arise and just to simply name it pleasant. Pleasant, unpleasant. So as I did this, whatever sense data came up, whatever thought came up, I'll notice what's that little flavor going on. And by doing so, you start to get a sense, what's the inclination of your mind? What's the inclination of your conditioning, really? And this leads to what's classically called your type, your aversive type or your craving type or delusional type. Sharon Salzberg would talk about this as if you walked into a room, what's the first thing that you notice? Do you notice what's attractive and pleasant in the room? Or do you notice what is maybe dirty or broken? This kind of gives a sense of where that basic mind state or that inclination is. Or if you just kind of don't notice the room at all, perhaps there's more of that delusional side. And so this sense of I say this not to categorize yourself or to make ourselves into a box or a constriction of who we are, but just as a way of noticing how our minds tend to incline, how our minds tend to bias. And much of the practice, much of the freedom is learning to not be constrained by that, to see it, to understand it, and to see its inherent emptiness. So we've been looking at this thing of Vedana in a very simple way, almost as if there's one point of contact, there's one Vedana, and then we go into craving, clinging, etc. And it's like this simple cycle, one trigger and one thing goes through, down the cycle. But actually, it's much more complex than that. It's much more in real life. There's all these things that are happening at once. It's almost a compounding effect that can happen with Vedana. That Vedana, a point of contact with a Vedana can lead to a mind state, which then has its own Vedana, its own reaction to it. So let's make this a little more concrete example. So let's say I was talking to a friend recently who has they live on the opposite side of the political conservative liberal spectrum. Right, so I'm having a conversation and they say something that is opposite of what I believe, opposite of what my beliefs are. And that moment of hearing, so that's the point of contact, they're just saying these words, the stating of an opinion. And immediately there's a sense of unpleasant Vedana that arises with that. There's a sense of not liking. Right? From that point of unpleasantness, I go into aversion, going into not liking it. So saying something that may be on a political or religious social justice spectrum that's opposite of my beliefs. So just this one moment of hearing, moment of Vedana, and almost immediately there's a reaction in my body, reaction in my heart, reaction in the emotions. You have this maybe a stream of thoughts, or for me there's kind of a physical somatic sense of tightening in my chest, jaw getting a little more set, a reaction in the body. There's a sense of emotionality that comes up. Like, how can that person have this belief? How can they have this view? You know, that sense of wanting to convince, to argue, to defend. All this can arise very quickly from this moment of contact. And each of these points, the tightness in the jaw, the sense of tightness in the chest, the emotion of outrage or indignation, all become moments of contact. Each of those moments of contact have a quality being pleasant or unpleasant or neutral. And from there goes into more reactivity. So you can see how one moment of contact and that Vedana can quickly lead to many more moments. Like if you've ever seen one of those time-lapse photos of a ice crystal starting. There's just a little speck, and then moment after moment, it starts to spread to bigger and bigger spreading of ice as one crystal leads to another. So this is the self-perpetuating mechanism of dependent origination. This is why we're in such a fix. This is why things are so difficult. This is why there's so much suffering. It's so hard for us to listen to each other, to find that place of ease and peace. Because we're so much of our time caught in reaction upon reaction. It's self-perpetuating. So we're chugging along with our reactions upon our reactions. It's like dropping a coin into the jukebox. And the moment, the Vedana is the moment of dropping that coin. And there's this whole mechanism that gets started, of the record dropping and the hand coming over and the playing of the music that lasts a certain time, all from this moment of contact. Now, the good news is that this is optional. This is not required. This is the whole point of the Buddha's practice. His whole training is that he said, if it wasn't possible, I would not ask you to do this. He's describing the origin of suffering, the second noble truth. He also, of course, talked about the third noble truth, the cessation of suffering. So when we find ourselves in the midst of one of these mind moments, these states of reactivity, whenever we wake up to that, we just say, okay, where is the nearest Vedana I can contact? You may not find the original one, but just find what is the state of mind right now. And what's this quality of being pleasant, of being unpleasant? Neutral is usually not going to generate a whole lot of, you know, a reaction. It's not going to create a lot of storms. We tend to check out or simply be present with. So pleasant and unpleasant, we can really focus on that. If I can touch that point of Vedana, if I can just simply acknowledge it, and we'll say it out loud, say, ah, this is a moment of unpleasant Vedana. You can often find your feet. You can often find the body and that sense of connection with this moment. Because remember at the beginning of the talk, Vedana and contact are happening right here in this moment, right in this very moment. And we add this whole elaboration that we live in. We live in our world of thought, of reactivity, of fantasy and desire, of worry, of anxiety. And so learning to contact, say, where is that Vedana? Gets us very close to the point of contact, which inherently then bring us back into this present moment, which allows us to shift from our reactivity into responsiveness. Connecting with Vedana allows us to take responsibility for our reaction, for our experience, instead of blaming the other person or the other circumstance. Allows us to start to listen deeply to someone else's perspective, other way of viewing the world, and have a mutually respectful dialogue. Because they would react the same way to my opinions, to my thoughts, my ideas. In this way, we can start to find that place of commonality, that sense of common ground, to find where is our way of dialoguing and finding our way through this polarization that so cripples our country and the world. Now, here's something that's interesting to notice with this sense of compounding effect of Vedana and how it creates one Vedana can create another Vedana, which creates another sense of a reactivity, another kind of this snowballing effect of the sense of self. And how that sense of self gets formed. Now, even if something that's kind of painful, like with my example, that sense of outrage, of being, you know, other strong emotions, of being indignant, and like, how can this other person have this opposing opinion? If we actually look at the Vedana that's there, we sometimes may be surprised to find the Vedana is actually pleasant. It actually feels good to be opinionated, to know that we're right and you're wrong, that the person is wrong. And we can find people who are like us and say, yeah, isn't that person so wrong? Yes, they are. And it feels good to feel so established, to feel so righteous. So this is a moment of honesty, a moment of sincerity, to notice that quality of Vedana that's there, that deep down, it's pleasant to be formed. It's pleasant to be established. What I mean by that, to be formed to the sense of I, who has this opinion, and the sense of you who has the wrong opinion, the sense of self, to be right, to be righteous. And consider that if you consider dropping this opinion, dropping this idea, dropping the argument, something that you deeply know that you're right and they're absolutely wrong. I think we all can think of those. That there's this deep conviction that I have the right way and other people don't. Imagine dropping being right. Imagine the other side let them win the argument. What kind of Vedana does that elicit? I think if we're honest, it elicits a unpleasant Vedana, a sense of abandoning our opinion, abandoning what's right, what needs the justice. And that unpleasant Vedana, which leads to fear, a sense of contraction. So we can then look at that and say, well, that means that the other Vedana was pleasant. The pleasantness of having this opinion. If I consider dropping it and it elicits an unpleasant Vedana, I was holding on to this. This gives us a nice entryway into this hunger to be, the tanha, this thirst to become, the thirst to form into the sense of me. So back to my conservative friend, knowing that I am right and they are wrong, and how I can find lots of people in my circle, talk to my wife and say, isn't this guy off in his opinion? Get righteous in my opinion, secure in my convictions. If this itself is dukkha, this is dukkha. And this is very hard, I think, for many of us to let go of, to be willing to set aside our opinion, to realize any opinion has an equal validity. Any thought is equally valid or equally invalid. This asks something very deep of us to set aside, to shift from our normal way of being in the world that many of us are not willing to do. Because it's so challenging. It's so against our what we've built our life on, perhaps. Now, from a practice perspective, we can look at this as, what do we add to the moment? What are we adding to this point of contact? You can see the moment contact, a sound, a thought, a sensation, and the Vedana, pleasant, unpleasant. And then see, what do we add to it? In this way, we see the past conditioning or past momentum. Our past programming creates this impulse to respond in a certain way, to react in a certain way. And Vedana is the very beginning of that impulse. It's the very first step along that. If we can come back to Vedana, we can start to interrupt the cycle. That's why it's so emphasized in the Buddhist teaching. It's considered the weakest link in dependent origination. Because if you can land right there in Vedana and stay connected to that, the whole thing starts to fall away. It falls away both from this moment of reactivity, but even more profoundly, the way of being not reactive to this moment conditions us to not be reactive to the next time this arises. It starts to undercut this whole cycle of ignorance and of suffering. So simply adding nothing to the moment, such a common instruction in meditation. Just meet the breath, meet the sensations of the body, meet the sound without adding one thing to it. Meeting with a steadiness of attention, a quiet attention. So going back to this analogy of the gas in the car and the gas pedal, you know, putting the pedal down when it's in first is moving toward experience based on that pleasant Vedana. Reverse is moving away based on unpleasant. But what if we don't step on the gas? What if we don't move with that Vedana? This starts to change the momentum. It starts to change the conditioning of our lives. It starts to change the programming, so there's less and less charge that arises. This is easily said, and it's one of the hardest things we can do is to do nothing with this moment's experience, especially those ones that have such a pull, such a drive, an impulse toward reactivity into selfing. Is to learn to come back to that point of contact and that point of Vedana and just notice this is unpleasant or this is pleasant. And noticing the impulse to move without moving. To notice the impulse to move without moving. Starts to interrupt this whole cycle of dependent origination, which is another way to say it, is interrupt the deep roots of our suffering. Interrupt the deep roots of our suffering. So we start to find we don't have as strong of an impulse to move with. And this is something that isn't uniform for most people. That we may find inroads into this, maybe hearing something like a bird song, seeing the beauty of nature, and we're able to see it with a complete freshness, with a complete innocence, with a complete immediacy. All ways of saying what I've been saying all night without moving from the Vedana, staying with the point of contact. And in that we find suddenly there's this profound intimacy, this profound falling away of separation, as we are simply connected to what we're observing, the sense of knowing and known merge. And then you get a call from your mother-in-law, and suddenly you're in this state of reactivity. the next moment, or someone honks your horn, or your neighbor starts up their power washer and makes this big racket. So it's important to be humble in this, that realize that there's having that taste is so helpful. And then we start to see that taste reveals the North Star, which direction is true north. And how can I start to find that in these much more charged, complex things of interpersonal relationships, of personal, of our own relationship to ourselves, those hard parts of ourselves we hold outside of our heart, how we keep ourselves trapped. This is why sometimes spiritual teachers really make profound, unskillful actions in their lives. They can be very deeply realized in some areas, but then in other areas, they abuse their power, abuse sexuality, and cause tremendous harm. So we always want to have that humbleness, that realization that it's a moment, it's really a relationship to the moment that is needed. And never hold the sense that we've arrived. To always be listening to, where's that Vedana? Where's that heart of the moment? So this brings us to this other aspect of tonight's theme. We've been talking about this movement from Vedana, how we go into dependent origination, go into the cycle of suffering. And now to move into this other aspect, and when we don't move from Vedana, when Vedana arises and we simply are be still with it, be quiet with it. Now be forewarned that this leads to less self-referencing. It leads to a sense of the landscape falling away. The normal reference points of self and other, of isolation, of distance, of opinion, of self-belief, fall away. This is the territory this moves toward, and this is the essence of what the Buddha taught and pointed toward. As I mentioned last week in the Foam Sutta, this beautiful sutta on the five aggregates, where the Buddha is using these analogies from the natural world. Suppose then the autumn, when it's raining in fat, heavy drops, a water bubble were to appear and disappear on the water, and a person with good eyesight were to see it, observe it, and appropriately examine it. To them, seeing it, observing it, and appropriately examining it, it would appear empty, void, without substance. For what substance would there be in a water bubble? And he says, and it goes on to say, in the same way, when we see a moment of Vedana, a moment of feeling tone, of being pleasant or unpleasant, this also is empty, would also appear empty, void, without substance. So you start to touch into Vedana, you may very well be touching into this sense of emptiness, the sense of not moving from it into a sense of a reactivity, into a sense of selfing. And so as we orient our practice toward Vedana, we start to find that point of pleasant and unpleasant, and just resting there, we're starting to move toward this emptiness of self, this emptiness of self-referencing. And this includes dropping away all the trappings, all the movement, all the impulses, the opinions, the referencing, the suffering. Now, suffering, sometimes we have this idea with our practice that suffering, end of suffering, is a little bit like heaven, that we're basically the same. You know, I still have my ideas, I'm still here, I can go there with my spouse and my children. Just everything is pleasant. No one's hurting, no one's in having any distress. Wishes that we have are granted almost as soon as we have them. And I'm not speaking in this in terms of a Christian idea of heaven, but actually the Buddhist idea. There's this whole cosmology of these heavenly realms. And if we live a good life, we go into these heavenly realms where life is very good. Things are very pleasant. Our wishes are realized before we even have them. But the Buddha was extremely clear and absolutely clear that those states, those realms, are still dukkha. They're still subject to impermanence. They're still subject to a sense of insufficiency. It's hard to see them because they may last for eons, for long periods. But essentially, they are dukkha, and that's not what he was pointing toward in the essence of his practice. Liberation is very different. See, it becomes stillness, becomes something that moves through us. It's not us observing it. It starts to move from us. We become one and the same with that stillness. And this confronts this deep hunger to be, to stay invested in the sense of me, to have that opinion. And you can get a taste of that with that vedana, with that sense of noticing when I'm caught in an opinion and I may be having all this unpleasant vedana come up. There's an unpleasantness of being formed, this pleasantness of being, you know, I am here. I am having this opinion. And you're having the opposite opinion and you're wrong. There's a pleasantness in that sense. That's why vedana is so emphasized. It becomes this gateway. This poem that I read during at the end of the meditation, you know, points to this falling away of our container. Our sense of this is me having this experience, me having this life. You see something that's much more profound beyond it. So no water, no moon. When the nun Shunyono studied Zen under Bukō of Engaku, she was unable to attain the fruits of meditation for a long time. At last, one moonlight night, she was carrying water in an old pail bound with bamboo. The bamboo broke and the bottom fell out of the pail. And at that moment, Shunyono was set free. In commemoration, she wrote a poem. In this way and that, I tried to save the old pail. Since the bamboo strip was weakening and about to break, until at last the bottom fell out. No more water in the pail. No more moon in the water. The falling out, the release of liberation. This is not, may not be what our vedana seeks, because there's that fear of losing that self-establishment, losing that sense of meanness. And yet if we're able to trust that, to keep practicing, at some point that pay will fall out. Or find ourselves with no moon, with no more water in the pail, no more moon in the water. All right, thank you for your kind attention. If you could just sit quietly for a few moments. So as we go into a chance for some dialogue about any comments or sharing or questions you might have, I'd like to first talk about the practice and reflection, the homework for this week. So I'll send that with a chat with a little luck. Okay, looks like I'm going to have to pull that out later. But I'll read it to you. The practice and reflection of vedana. So this week, notice how many things you do are initiated by vedana, this feeling tone. In the midst of reaching for something, doing something, speaking, or thinking, see if you can identify the initial vedana that triggered that action. Was it the subtle impression of being pleasant, of being unpleasant, or neutral? So remember, pleasant can lead to that wanting more of. Unpleasant can lead to moving away from. And neutral can lead to either one, that sometimes we want to find something more engaging, more juicy to connect with, because it's boring just to connect with that sense of neutrality. And then what happens to the impulse to act when we rest in that point of contact? We allow ourselves to connect with vedana in a very simple way, a very deep way. See if that, what that does to that, in the impulse to act, impulse to do with. And this, I was having dinner with my family tonight, and I find myself reaching across the table to take a bite of my daughter's dish, my fork was paused, and I realized, oh, I should ask permission. And she pointed that out, that it's better to ask first before you start to reach. And this is an example, like I was in the middle of reaching. I was caught in this moment of pleasantness, of wanting to taste that pad thai in this case, and that movement toward, and I was in the midst of it. And I didn't, was even aware of that. And the point of noticing, okay, I'm moving from this point of pleasantness. So practicing with that, seeing what comes from that exploration, I think you'll find it very fruitful. And I sent that along in a chat, so you can copy and paste that for a more accessible way. All right, so if there's any comments or questions, let me give you permission to unmute yourself. All right, so you're welcome to ask that. You could chat if you want. Send me a chat, but I may not see it. All right, any sharing, any questions?
Jim, it seems like if I was, you know, had a, say somebody spoke and I had a reaction that I didn't express, but my, you know, first contact and my perception, and then was unpleasant for a moment. But then sometimes I try to, when I get that, I work my way back to neutral. I may not be into pleasant, but to find a neutral space there where if it's a conversation or somebody has an opinion, to move back into neutral and to use my sense organs, my ears, to hear what they're saying and see what I can learn, I guess, about their perspective or their conditioning. Is that part of the Vedana stuff or what?
You know, that's a great question, Ron, because that's often what we try to work with as meditators, is we find ourselves in a state of reactivity, and we try to come back to that place of a receptivity, of balance, of being able to hear the other person. And it does have a quality of being more neutral, has this feeling of being spacious. And I think what often gets a little confused here is that the Vedana is this almost, it's really an inherent flavoring of this moment. So there may be saying something that's still, you inherently find it unpleasant from a Vedana standpoint, but you can just notice that and not go into their sight, into reactivity. You can go into that quality of simply being responsive. This is something that we you know, teach as meditators, is how do we, you know, feel something that's unpleasant in the body and still be with it. You know, that's like that template of learning how to turn towards something unpleasant. Okay, it's unpleasant, but I'm going to be curious with it. I'm going to turn toward it. Same exact process as we listen to someone who's, you know, maybe triggering us or feeling charged around. The words may have an unpleasant quality, but if we're able to come back to a sense of responsiveness, we're not going to the next cycle, okay? And in the midst of that, again, remember how it's a compounding action, that you're able to listen, suddenly new sets of Vedana are coming up because you're acting in a responsive, receptive mode. When you're really listening, that's inherently a different Vedana than when you're reactive. So I don't know if I'm making sense, but it's like the Vedana is this really subtle quality, almost like a hair breadth from the moment's experience. Just as it's like a slight decline this way or that way. And then from there we go into reactivity. Go ahead.
Yeah, it does make sense, because the incident that I'm kind of relating this to was somebody who was, I wasn't going to know again. I was just a chance meeting, not a chance, but pretty chance meeting. But for moving from this unpleasantness to neutral, then the other person moved more to a neutral position as well. You know, I mean, the reactivity changed, and that continued to change. And what was most likely going to be about a 4 or 5 minute transaction, wound up being a conversation that lasted about 20 minutes. And not any one of us changed our opinion so much, but we did, maybe at least for me, have a little different perception of what somebody who's different to me is like, what their conditioning is.
Yeah, yeah, beautiful. Yeah, that sense of being willing to not act from our reactivity, act from the unpleasantness, allows us to actually make contact with someone. And I think I always appreciate the chance to be able to hear someone speak who has a different political belief, different religious belief, because it's like, wow, this is a very different way of viewing the world. And to have a dialogue, even though I may not change my mind and they may not change their mind, there's this sense of connection there. And I think that's a beautiful way to meet life. And you can see that how it can go from this kind of gritchy, short time conversation to actually something that's much more meaningful. Yeah, so thank you for sharing that, Ron. Looks like Kathy sent a chat saying, wondering about personal morality, right or wrong. How does that relate to Vedana? And is it unauthentic to see your reaction and not acknowledge it? Let's take the first aspect of that in terms of morality. So Vedana, again, it's really helpful to not take that as being an absolute permission to act, right? Because we all know we see something shiny in the store and we have this impulse to just take it and put it in our pocket perhaps, or to take the extra cookie, or to, you know, there's more, of course, extreme and destructive ways of manifesting that. That would be following that quality of Vedana, of pleasant Vedana, or unpleasantness. We hear something, we sense something we have an unpleasant Vedana arise, and we might act from that. We may say something unkind, or lash out, or strike out, all based on that unpleasant Vedana. So we can't use that as a Vedana as a basis for ethics or for morality. We have to have a deeper compass. That's what I was touching on in the talk, is that sense of where is really our true north. You know, what is that deeper sense of what is really true, not our preferencing of liking or disliking, because then remember that's conditioned. You know, if we've spent our lives stealing and harming, it's going to be hard to stop doing that. That's going to feel inherently unpleasant. If we're caught in a pattern of addiction, seeking the object of addiction is pleasant, but yet from the perspective of knowing that's harmful, harm causes harm to ourselves and others. And so it comes from a different place, the sense of ethics and morality. It really ideally comes from our wisdom, our sense of direct seeing again through the Veda, not believing pleasant or unpleasant, but seeing something that's deeper than that. This is how it's placed in the Eightfold Path of three elements of wise action, is supported by our mindfulness practice and concentration and our wisdom of wise view and wise intention. And the second aspect of your question was, is it inauthentic to see your reaction and not acknowledge it? Well, you know, that's a great question, because you can see this reaction in us. And as meditators, we become more and more sensitive to what's going on in our minds and our hearts. And often we see that and we kind of wish we didn't see it. Maybe a little bit like the Matrix, when some of the characters wish they could go back asleep and, you know, not wake up to the reality of the world. I think Ruth King, I think of her, she's a famous, now deceased meditation teacher, talked about once you practice, you lose the ability to get away with anything, that you start to know yourself more and more deeply. You notice when the motivation is aligned and when it's malaligned, when it's everything's connected and feels a sense of integrity, and when it's not that way. And so I'd say, yeah, there's an authenticness to knowing that, at least for yourself, to acknowledge it for yourself. It doesn't mean you'll have to always say it to someone else. There's the whole skillfulness of action, the skillfulness of when to say something and when not to. I mean, there's many things that come up in my mind that I don't share with another person. And Joseph said, if you broadcast the context of his mind on a screen, nobody would come to hear him talk. So yes, it's Ruth Dennison. Thank you for that, Iris. She's the teacher I was speaking of. All right, what else is out there? Did I address your questions, Kathy?
Yes, thank you, Tim. That's great. I forgot about non-harming.
Yep, that's always a good base to come back to. All right, we have space for a few more questions. Go ahead, Kaba.
Tim, would you say then, as I'm understanding, or am I understanding, that Vedana is that moment, I don't want to say action in the sense of what we see ourselves do, but Vedana precedes some kind of action, whether a mental grab or a physical grab. Is that kind of the direction you're pointing?
Yeah, Vedana is, in some ways, an inherent conditioning we have on each moment's experience. It may or may not lead to an action. It may not lead to anything. It may just be a noticing. But it's just that subtle sense of being pleasant or unpleasant. And I think we can notice that inclines us toward action, inclines us toward impulse. It doesn't have to. We can have action arise from a very different place. It's not driven by conditioning. It's not driven by, you know, by our unconsciousness. This is why the Buddha was still able to be in the world for 40 years after he became awakened. And there's this different way of life moves through us. But for a long time, there's that sense of Vedana arises, and then we quickly like it or dislike it, pleasant or unpleasant, then liking or disliking, and then doing something about it. And does that make sense? It's kind of this sequencing. So we're talking about almost microseconds. It can almost seem like it's one and the same. But if we become more concentrated, have this level of samadhi, or just a level of interest, or if it's a pretty quiet thing, you can start to see, oh, there's the moment of contact. There's the sense of being pleasant or unpleasant. And there's perhaps the impulse to move it toward it or away from it. And so in the homework, I'm suggesting to notice when you're in the midst of movement is just pause for a second and say, okay, what Vedana might be driving this? Can I connect with that? Because it's often so unconscious that we don't even realize we're reaching for the cookie without even seeing that sense of being pleasantness. We're already being moved, not by Vedana, but by our craving around it, our desire, to use the dependent origination words. Does that help, Kaba? Yeah, good. All right, what other questions or comments might be out there in the cyber world?
Hi, Tim.
Hello.
Hi. In the situation you just described, and you're saying stay quiet and just notice it. And then in your talk, you mentioned that this moves us toward emptiness.
Yes.
I wonder if you could expand on that a little bit.
Sure, Joyce. So that sense of when Vedana arises, when we've come back, kind of trace ourselves back to that impulse of, or really before the impulse, really the quality of being pleasant or unpleasant, we're able just to rest with that. We're kind of undercut this whole momentum of selfing. So like an example of, let's say I have something that I'm kind of preconditioned to really desire, to want in my life. And I'm just going about my day and suddenly an image of that comes up. So the image is just the sight of that. There's the name and form that kind of sets up this whole this tendency, this programming to move toward it, right? So then there's this pleasant Vedana that arises. And then I might go, so I find myself reaching for it or seeking it before I even realize that. But I wake up to the fact I'm reaching for it, and I can say, okay, let's kind of let go of the object and come back to that sense of pleasantness. Like, oh, this is a pleasant experience. This is something that elicits this pleasantness. And if I'm able to just be very still with that and to relax, really, this part of it is you have to suspend the object and you have to kind of suspend the impulse to move toward that object to just feel the sense of pleasantness in itself, right? And it's interesting to do this because often it becomes uncomfortable because we're so used to moving with that pleasantness. This is the power of our sankharas kind of pushing us forward into doing something, to seeking it. And yet if we're able to be still with it and kind of let that, all that turmoil, all that sense of reactivity, how the impulse quiet down, we may be able to simply relate to that object from a place of quiet, a place of stillness. So by doing this, so, you know, over time and with sincerity, you start to find the next time that object arises, there's a choice that arises. There's a sense of not having to chase after it. And instead you can feel, oh, there's an object, and there's this almost feels like a dry firing, like like if you had a gun without a bullet and you fired it and it didn't, there's nothing that blew up. It'd be just the action, going through the action with nothing coming from that. So you start to see it more almost dispassionately without the charge. And then you can start to see that movement toward leads to that movement of selfing. And so often we have to kind of work through it a bit to get things quiet enough. And really what's doing that, what's happening is when we're able to be quiet like that, we're starting to create this whole new level of conditioning and programming to meet the moment in a non-reactive, a non-craving-based way, in relationship to this one object. That often becomes a gateway into that stillness. And then from there, the stillness starts to take root and it starts to show itself in more and more ways. I think an easier way to work with it is something that's not so charged in our life. Like just sitting out in your backyard or in a park and you hear the sound of a bird. And you can just hear that and notice how it has a pleasant quality perhaps, or unpleasant, but how you can don't have to move with it. You don't have to do anything with it. And by relating to it that way, you start to find that that distance falls away. Now, what I mean by not relating to it that way is like there's no impulse to name it, to try to maintain it longer than its natural life. There's no, you're relaxing the impulse to even form into the sense of joyousness around that, the sense of timness in relationship to it. And so that often leads to a little bit of, well, where's the ground that I usually stand on? It starts to fall away. But in its place, there's this deep intimacy that arises with that, this deep sense of connection that arises with it. Does that make sense, Joyce? Does that help?
Yeah, I think it does. It seems like a process of, well, on one level, of changing your conditioning. Of, you know, you're describing a conditioned reaction that I don't move with, and then kind of changing it to stillness, to no reaction to it.
Yes.
And you're saying over time, the intimacy with that stillness, you know, you're able to see more emptiness through wisdom.
Yes. Yes. If I could like outline the ideal way of working with this, let's say, you know, find a series of sense data that is pretty neutral. It doesn't create there's not a lot of inherent programming with it. There's not a lot of momentum behind it. And by doing that, learn to relate to it in a very direct, immediate way. So you start to see, you know, okay, there's the Vedana, there's a slight impulse to move toward if it's pleasant, away from if it's unpleasant. But it's, since it's so neutral, it doesn't have much charge to me, I can practice being still with it. And you just allow that to deepen more and more so that stillness, that sense of separation starts to fall away. Once you kind of get a really strong taste of that, then you say, okay, let's bring that into parts that get reactive, parts that have much bigger of a charge. And, you know, life will provide that in constant ways for you. But it's really helpful to have that kind of taste to say, well, underneath all this reactivity, there's still that stillness inherently in it. When you start to see it directly, you realize, I'm not going to get fooled by the elaboration, by the complexity, by the reactivity elicits. And so then you're able to kind of work your way through. And this is one pathway to work with it, is connecting with the Vedana. Thank you, Joyce. All right, maybe one more before we have some announcements. Sashi, go ahead and unmute yourself. And if you raise your hand, I may not see it because I'm only looking at a few screens. So feel free to unmute yourself if I'm not seeing you. So go ahead, Sashi.
Yeah, I just wanted to give a little color commentary, because the word Vedana is used very commonly in my language, the South Indian language, Malayalam, and it's sort of devolved or deteriorated into just meaning a pain. Like you could have a stomach pain, which would be a Vedana, or a headache, that'd be a Vedana. Hmm. So interestingly, it's just used in the pain side and not the positive experience.
Interesting.
Just a little aside.
Yeah, thank you, Sashi. So, you know, the Sri Lankan language uses it that way.
No, this is actually Malayalam, which is a South Indian language.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so that, you know, many of those languages originally, you know, Pali is perhaps one of the roots, as well as Sanskrit. Yeah. And so that sense of kind of going back to the, it's like when we go look at a root word in English, the old English, right. You know, where is that? Well, often it's not how we use it these days. So
No.
Yeah, so and I think that sense of pain, and that's often that's the whole one third of the Vedana spectrum, but it's often when it really moves us, that really activates our action. Yeah, thank you for sharing that.
Thank you.
All right, any other comments or questions?
I'll just say something to add to Shashti's comment about Vedana being a pain. Actually, the pleasant does lead to pain of clinging and grasping and becoming. So maybe that's part of the way it's associated with pain.
Yeah, that's
and the pain of neutrality. You know, leads to the pain of, you know, trying to make something more interesting or ignoring it altogether. So anyway, I just thought about that.
Yeah, thank you, Lauren. Yeah, certainly in the dependent origination in Vedana is that the next critical step toward suffering. I mean, we have the steps of craving and clinging and becoming and birthing and then old age and death and suffering. But it kind of jumps to that, the way you're describing that. All right, thank you, Lauren. So we have a few announcements, and Kaba will be offering those. And just to say, next week, Tori Sala will be back and teaching for 2 months, going into two very critical aspects of dependent origination of craving and clinging. This is when we start to really get engaged in our suffering and our selfing. All right, Kaba, please take it away.
Thank you, Tim. That was very rich. I'm excited about the homework. There's eight. There are eight announcements, five exciting opportunities for us that are all on the calendar, and then a call out for some volunteers and a little information about a recording. So, okay, July 31st, Devin and Greg Haas will do an evening talk, followed by August 1st, a day-long retreat, of course, all on Zoom. And the title is Surviving Modern Life.
So there are two, you know, newer teachers. They have a nice, fresh energetic presentation. So I really encourage you to check them out and to hear the new generation of teachers coming down from IMS. Go ahead.
Nice. Day of Mindfulness, which is the end, the final day of Tim's meditation, beginning meditation talks, will be August 15th. The Buddhist Essentials by our local teachers is still continuing, and August 19th is the next one, 7 p.m., Jerry Harder and Suze Appel, perhaps is how you say it. Of course, our wonderful Monday sits continue and our Thursday sits. Let's see, August 22nd, Introduction to Concentration Meditation Retreat, a day-long retreat by Tina Rasmussen. And Tim, do you want to say something about Tina?
Sure, yeah, Tina is focused a lot on this quality of concentration, of samadhi, so how to have that collected sense of attention. So she's gonna be teaching an evening talk and then a day long. So I encourage you to look at the website. I think she has a link to her site and you can get more information about that whole practice. It's one of the important links to in our tradition and in our development as meditators. Thank you, Gaba.
Okay, last two. They're a full recording of the SIMS Climate Change Action Group gathering that happened July 11th is going to be available, probably is now available, on our website under the Social Engagement tab. And I know lots of people heard really good things about that. It was very well attended, so I'm sure it's very rich. Okay, the last thing is two volunteers are needed. I'm not going to do the lengthy details of what's needed, but just briefly, one person with some Zoom experience that could help co-host events such as this and our other events, and training will be provided. And the other is someone with video editing experience that could help process and upload our events, event recordings, is that right? And maybe could we put up there that Cheryl, can we put up there Ken's email right now, or should we just tell people to go to the website?
Oh, is Ken here? I don't have his email handy.
Oh, sorry. Why would you?
Yeah. If you have it, go ahead and put it up there. That's good. If anybody's interested.
Yeah, if you've ever watched a video online, you know, from our Zoom talks or from others. I mean, we have volunteers to do that. And we have a few of them who do a lot of the work, and it's time to help share the load and offer your support. And you get the first chance to listen to the talk. And I see Ken's email has been sent up by Iris. And so, you know, these are easy jobs. These are easy to do.
Oh, his email.
I have his email here.
So oh, let's see. Yeah. Let's all not talk over each other for a second. Sorry. So just I encourage you to volunteer. We're an all volunteer organization, and your support and your engagement keeps SIMS, you know, active and healthy, and it allows you to really participate in a deeper way. Thank you.